From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The Supreme Court is now in session. The High Court began its new term this week with just 8 justices on the bench. How does the empty seat influence which cases the court decides to hear and how the justices rule? University of Baltimore law professor Michael Meyerson steps us through some of the arguments over criminal law the High Court will hear this term, including a case that could upend the longstanding interpretation of the Fifth Amendment.
So this case basically raises the issue of, does the double jeopardy clause prevent a state from going after someone after the federal government does?
And we discuss the contentious nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh and its potential impact on how the public perceives the court, all on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The Supreme Court began its 2018 term on Monday with just 8 justices on the High Court's bench and scores of cases waiting for them. How does the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy change the ideology of the court? How does an open seat on the court affect the cases it hears? And how might allegations of sexual assault by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh impact public perception of the nomination process and the court itself? Joining me to discuss these issues is Michael Meyerson, the D.L.A. Piper Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where he teaches courses on American legal history and constitutional law. Meyerson is also director of the Fannie Angelos Program for Academic Excellence. Welcome back to On the Record.
Thanks for having me.
Justice Kennedy served on the Supreme Court for 30 years. He was nominated by President Reagan. What role did Kennedy play in the court?
He was what's known as the swing justice. Everyone who was arguing for the court for the last several decades directed their arguments to him because in a court that was liberal and conservative, evenly split 4-4, he was the fifth vote. So if he was on a conservative side, they might strike down various laws if they were that favored certain interests. If they were liberal laws, they would go the other way. And he was able to actually be the voice of the Supreme Court for more than a couple of decades.
And point out a couple of cases.
Okay, the most sort of famous ones involve things like gay marriage, where he was the fifth vote to say that the Constitution required states to recognize gay marriage. He also was the fifth vote upholding the rules on affirmative action that let race be considered by universities. On the other hand, there were many, many criminal cases where he sided with the conservatives and voting rights cases where he sided with the conservatives. So it was never clear which way he would go, but it always mattered which way he went.
Some court watchers have speculated that Chief Justice Roberts is poised to be the next swing vote.
That is certainly the best guess. Chief Justice Roberts upheld the Obamacare against challenges, which shocked and angered many conservatives. And so it does look like he will be the next swing vote, assuming that the ninth justice is a conservative voice.
How does an unfilled seat on the bench affect which cases the court decides to hear?
Because a justice court can split 4-4, wasting everyone's time without an important ruling, the court tries to avoid hearing cases of any import, of any controversy, when there are only 8 justices. So if you look at what the court has agreed to hear so far for this term, they've been very, very few truly important cases, what we call blockbuster cases, because they don't have a ninth vote to be a tiebreaker.
Would you expect that to change if the Senate makes a decision on a new justice?
If they approve of a ninth justice, the Supreme Court will start hearing cases. Most likely it would be the term after that, when they knew they were settled, where all the real cases that mattered would come down.
Can the court rehear a case when a ninth justice is added?
The court can always rehear a case for a lot of reasons. There may be a dispute. They may want to clarify an issue. But absolutely, when there are only 8 justices, especially when the preliminary vote is tied, they can often rehear an argument with the ninth vote available.
The most recent addition to the court, of course, is Justice Neil Gorsuch. He was nominated by President Trump to succeed the late Antonin Scalia. He's been on the court since April 2017. How has Gorsuch fit into the court?
At the moment, he has fit in pretty much the way the conservatives who supported him wanted him to. He's been a very close ally of Justice Thomas, one of the most, if not the most, conservative voice on the court, and he has not truly surprised anyone yet. I will say, though, he's still early in his tenure, and justices have a tendency to not be exactly what they were in 10 years than they were at the beginning.
That's University of Baltimore Law Professor Michael Meyerson here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the changing makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court. I think all our listeners know that President Trump in July nominated Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh now serves on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Allegations have emerged of sexual misbehavior by Kavanaugh, highly contentious hearings last week. Just this confirmation process, messy, some would say painful, what impact will it have, in your view, on public perceptions of the court?
Sadly, we'll make the public view the court as even more political than it has viewed it. For many, many years, the court was seen as the least political branch. At this point, I suspect left and right will see the court as no different than the House of Representatives. You vote for your side, for your result, rather than the way we're supposed to select justices based on temperament, intelligence, and neutrality.
Given that justices tend only to speak with their decisions on cases, how would the court regain the public's trust?
That's an incredibly hard question, I'm afraid, because I think the public has to start trusting someone before it starts trusting the court. I'm afraid that as long as the process is as ugly as it is, the court will be viewed as part of the political process. I would think probably if the court justices started voting in a surprising way, if Democratic justices voted with Republican justices, they might not be seen as Democrat and Republican anymore, but justices. So I would argue if they left their silo and voted in ways we didn't expect, we might view them in ways we don't expect.
Judge Kavanaugh is said to have a record of strong views about presidential power.
That's correct. He has a very expansive view of presidential power, believing that the president should have a broad amount of autonomy in how the president carries out his job. Now, that is not necessarily concerning. It is not way out of the mainstream on most issues. However, the question is, when an actual issue comes before him, will he use his views on expansive presidential power to protect the person who appointed him? That's the frightening question.
Some people have said he should recuse himself from some of these particular cases that may come up involving President Trump. Do you see any possibility of that?
The Supreme Court's rules on recusal is that it's an individual choice. So each justice decides when they think they should not hear a case. And so generally, if people want to hear a case, they're going to hear it, even the public thinks they probably should not.
You pay a lot of attention to the Supreme Court. What's it been like for you watching the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation process?
It's been actually very depressing for a lot of reasons. First, for the obvious reason of watching a human being like Dr. Ford suffer and be humiliated, partly because I truly believe the Supreme Court should be held to a higher standard. I think we function better as a country when the Supreme Court is truly viewed as a neutral arbiter trying to do the right thing. And watching Judge Kavanaugh go after Hillary Clinton and liberals made me just feel that no one in front of him as a lawyer could feel confident that he would truly be neutral. And that is a very frightening concept.
Well, let me ask you about that, because there are some who say that critics of Judge Kavanaugh are focusing on temperament because they realize it will be so hard to actually prove the facts of the allegations against him of misbehavior, and that it's a tactic.
I think we're focusing on temperament because we have never seen anything like the display he did. The disrespect he showed the senators, and I got to say, the disrespect he showed female senators, the women, made you think, what does this guy actually view of women? Can he truly dismiss people so completely? He put his temperament at issue by screaming, cutting people off, and by treating people with disrespect.
If he fails to be confirmed, what, though, are the implications for future nominees to the Supreme Court?
I worry greatly. I think there are no holds barred. I think it will be a vicious cycle for everyone, Democrat or Republican. I don't see a simple way out of people getting nastier and nastier.
If Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation falls apart, what can you tell us about who President Trump might choose to replace him?
When President Trump was candidate Trump, he released a list of 25 names put together by the Conservative Federalist Society. This was done to make sure conservative voters knew that President Trump, if elected, would appoint the kind of justices they want. That is the list he has drawn from. So if you think about it, it's a 25-person list, and Gorsuch is gone. And if Kavanaugh is gone, we'll just keep going down the list. There's no priority, but they're all essentially the same politically and judicially.
So some people feel like the court has become too political, but is there a way in which a political process might address problems that Democrats see on the court?
Well, if the Democrats find that the court is being filled with people selected through an improper process, whether it's Gorsuch going into a seat that was held open for more than a year, or whether it's Justice Kavanaugh getting appointed through a system where an FBI investigation was truly inadequate, if the Democrats get control of the House and the Senate and win the presidency in 2020, it is absolutely constitutional to expand the number of justices. Democrats could pass a law saying instead of 9 justices, there would be 11 justices, for example, and then appoint 2 justices to balance this out. The number 9 is not in the Constitution. The number had been changed frequently at the beginning of our republic, and theoretically, at least, Democrats who were very, very disappointed in a process would have that as at least potential remedy.
That's University of Baltimore Law Professor Michael Meyerson. We're speaking about the Supreme Court nomination process. We're going to take a short break here on The Record on WIPR. And when we're back, we'll turn to the docket, the death penalty, double jeopardy. We'll hear about some of the criminal law cases before the High Court. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Cruel and unusual punishment, excessive criminal fines, and the dusky gopher frog, just a few components of some of the cases the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear this session. University of Baltimore Law Professor Michael Meyerson is here to guide us through them. Let's start with the death penalty. 2 days ago, the court heard arguments on Madison v. Alabama, a case involving Alabama death row inmate Vernon Madison. He was convicted in the killing of a police officer in the mid-1980s, and now he suffers from dementia. Pick up the story for us.
So the question is it cruel and unusual punishment to execute a person for a crime they don't remember committing? So previously, the Supreme Court has said if someone has such mental incapacity, they don't understand what execution means. They don't understand that they're being punished at all. It is cruel and unusual punishment to execute them. So no matter what crime they committed, they cannot be executed under the Constitution. The question here is the next step. If this person, if the defendant, is aware of what punishment means, is aware of what death means, but due to his vascular dementia, cannot remember the crime he committed, he's kind of being punished for something, and he doesn't quite know that he did it. And is that cruel and unusual punishment, even though he knows what punishment means?
The court has ruled in the past that states cannot execute individuals who are delusional or psychotic. How is this case different?
Because here, it's not a lack of knowledge of what punishment means. It's about his specific role in the crime he would be executed for.
Next month, the court will hear arguments in Bucklew v. Presythe.
Yes.
A case involving questions about the method of execution.
I have to admit, I find these cases very strange because the court basically says it's not cruel to kill you. The question is how we kill you. And the question becomes one person has essentially an allergy to the injection and says, execute me with gas in a nicer way. And the question is, does he have the right to demand a less torturous way to being killed? which seems like a very Alice in Wonderland argument to me. But on a very human level, it really matters to the question of, does the United States think it's constitutional to torture people? And that's a really deep question, I think.
What has the Supreme Court said about the method state used to execute
The Supreme Court has generally given very wide berth, does not analyze each of the different methods. So this exact question of an individual's right for his individual needs to avoid individual torture is really quite new to the court.
Is the Supreme Court likely to hear more cases in the future about the method of execution? I mean, we know that manufacturers of lethal injection drugs have halted the supplies to some U.S. prisons.
I would think that as those states that want to execute keep looking for new and different ways to do the execution, those who either oppose the death penalty or simply oppose particular means will continue challenging them.
Another case this term, Timms v. Indiana, will test the extent of the Eighth Amendment's protection against excessive fines. Tyson Timms used his Land Rover in drug deals. After he pleaded guilty to drug-related charges, the state of Indiana also sought to seize the Land Rover, but its value was about four times the $10,000 fine.
Okay, this is, in a way, an arcane legal question, but it reflects something very deep. When the original Constitution was written and the Bill of Rights was written, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, those limits only applied to the federal government. States could discriminate based on speech and have a favored religion. It wasn't until into the 20th century that the Supreme Court said, you know those amendments we did after the Civil War? They mean that most of the Bill of Rights applies to the states. So that's why speech laws and religion laws are all governed the same, whether the federal government or the state government is limiting almost all the Bill of Rights. Just recently, the Supreme Court said the Second Amendment applies to the states as well as the federal governments.
The right to bear arms.
Exact right to bear arms. Thank you. The question here is, does the Eighth Amendment ban on excessive fines, one of the few parts of the Bill of Rights that hasn't been applied to the states, does that also apply to the states? So would it be one more limitation on the state's ability to, say, use forfeiture to take all of this property, even though the defendant committed a very minor crime?
So that's what's at issue.
That is the sole constitutional issue in that case, yes.
The 14th Amendment provides for equal protection under the law. Why wouldn't it protect citizens from excessive fines?
The Equal Protection Clause decides whether two similarly situated people must be treated similarly or one can be treated differently. By contrast, excessive fines says that a given person's penalty or fine cannot greatly exceed the harm he has caused society. It is not a comparison to other people.
That's University of Baltimore Law Professor Michael Meyerson here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about cases before the Supreme Court this term. Next up, Gamble versus United States, a case on double jeopardy. Terrence Gamble is challenging his prosecution by federal officials for possessing a firearm as a felon after Alabama already convicted and sentenced him for the same offense.
Okay, so double jeopardy is a fundamental issue of fairness. The government cannot try you for the same crime twice. There's a sense that it should be final and the government can't keep going after you. However, there's an exception. Because we have a system of federalism with both federal and state governments, they each have an independent interest in enforcing their laws. So just because you've been tried in federal court doesn't mean you cannot be tried in state court for the same crime. So this case basically raises the issue of, does the double jeopardy clause prevent a state from going after someone after the federal government does? This issue has been settled for 150 years. The Supreme Court keeps saying the state has an independent interest and can proceed. We'll see if that is changed. Why it really matters, though, is the question of presidential pardons. At this point, the Mueller investigation is continuing because President Trump cannot pardon anyone against state challenges. So even if he pardoned everyone Mueller was investigating, New York State, Maryland could prosecute them for fraud and all these other crimes. So the pardon power does not protect the people Mueller is in questioning. If, however, the court were to rule that a federal pardon ended a federal lawsuit, and therefore the states could not proceed on the same lawsuit, a presidential pardon would be way more powerful and could actually encourage people to not talk to Mueller and wait for a presidential pardon.
Will the Supreme Court's approach to this question be shaped in part about how similar a federal and a state law are?
At this point, the fact that they are very similar, federal and state, doesn't stop the second prosecution because the state government is viewed as an independent sovereign. So the question would be, would we change that rule of law that's existed for more than a century and a half?
Does this case stand out to you compared to other cases the court has before it?
It certainly stands out as being the most prominent possibility of a case that will reverberate way beyond its simple fact pattern. This one could actually affect the investigation of President Trump.
If the Supreme Court changes the standard for double jeopardy, what other longer-term implications might that have?
I think, for me, the most frightening possibility is the court beginning to truly disrespect the concept of precedent. The whole rule of law is that law should not be changed. Supreme Court rulings should not be changed unless there's a truly, really important reason. And so we've occasionally overturned cases, but what we call settled law should be settled. And if the court cavalierly seems to get rid of 150 years of precedent without an obviously good reason, it makes me really worry about all the controversial cases, not least of which is Roe versus Wade, that could be just cast aside in the name of change without any due respect for precedent.
Let's end with a case the court heard on its first day in session this week, a case about a frog. Tell us about it.
Okay, so we all love the frog. We hope the frog doesn't become extinct. And in fact, the federal government is trying to keep the frog from becoming extinct. The question is actually relatively narrow. The federal government tried to declare that under the Endangered Species Act, land that the frog did not live on, but that could be made habitable for the frog, could be protected. This property is owned by some very large corporations that want to develop the property. And they have argued that if the frog isn't living there now, and would not be able to live there easily, the federal government has no interest. So it's really a question of how far can the federal government go in planning endangered species.
Is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service required to consider the economic impact to the landowners when designating a critical habitat?
The federal government must consider it, but they need not give it, I think the weight is much more to the very name of endangered species. That is who needs to be protected. So the key part of this lawsuit is whether or not, in weighing the value of protecting the frog, the government can consider property that the frog does not live on today.
So what are the implications beyond the dusky gopher frog?
I think the biggest impact is how the court views environmental issues. And this almost relates to even the climate change debate. Does the court see the federal government as having a role, in a broad role in protecting the environment, or want to keep it as narrow as possible?
I really appreciate your walking us through all this. It's nice to know what the court is going to be focusing on. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Michael Myerson is the D.L.A. Piper Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where he teaches courses on American legal history and constitutional law and directs the Fannie Angelos Program for Academic Excellence. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on The Record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.